All right, we're going to get to three teams that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet in the Pistons, the Nuggets, and the Kings. But we also, of course, have some news to get to as well. Lots of injuries piling up, sadly. First, I want to tell you about BetQL. If you want an edge over Vegas, download BetQL, the app you need to get an advantage this season. Discover value bets, line movement, and find out what bets the public backs with BetQL. The best part, BetQL is free to download from your mobile device. Head to betql.co, not .com, .co, betql.co, and use promo code CAPSPACE for your three-day trial. Give yourself an advantage over Vegas and download BetQL. That's betql.co, promo code CAPSPACE. See, I guess we can hit the news first here. Where did you want to start?
Well, I think we should start in Chicago, where Chris Dunn suffered a left MCL sprain, and the current estimate is 4 to 6 weeks. So that would be more of a moderate sprain. A severe one would be a longer absence. And so that means the Bulls are without Chris Dunn, Denzel Valentine, and Lauri Markkanen for a little while. And though it was done beforehand, one of the people who will shoulder some of that burden is Shaq Harrison. We talked about that a little bit, but the structure of the contract, because the Bulls did not have the ability to claim him off waivers, they guaranteed $250,000 for the current season, and then if he makes it to August 15th, then he will have $175,000 guaranteed for next season. So it's less team friendly than the contract if they had been able to claim him off waivers, but still pretty dang team friendly.
Yeah, and no surprise that the Bulls are also leaning towards using the stretch provision on Omer Asik per Casey Johnson. They have only $3 million guaranteed for him next year, but by stretching him, they can reduce that to $1 million, and they have big cap space aspirations for next summer, as so many teams do, and that will allow them to preserve as much of that as possible with him no longer on the roster. And there's still the hope that perhaps due to a long-term injury exclusion that could be wiped out for them entirely. That Dunn injury, likely a grade 2 MCL sprain of that timetable, is a little shorter than you'll see sometimes for grade 2 MCLs, but keep in mind he actually finished the game and then got a precautionary MRI, and they're like, oh yeah, you actually have a pretty bad MCL strain. So Dunn has only played one game, essentially. Now he was on paternity leave before that. So not looking good for the Bulls, who sit at 0-3. Dunn at least gave them some defense at the point. Harrison can do that too. And Zach LaVine talking about how the offense, they weren't getting the ball to the right people, i.e. him, which is a fair criticism considering he's been on fire lately, and Dunn made some bad decisions down the end. But this isn't going to help the Bulls offense. I mean, they really, with Markkanen out, they've only got one creator in LaVine. They don't have a ton of spacing. Bobby Portis, like, they've been playing him some at center too. Wendell Carter quietly hasn't had the greatest start to the season. Robin Lopez is looking pretty tired at this point. So things not going to turn around for the Bulls. Hopefully they won't start 3-20 like they did last year with like one of the worst ever point differentials at the start.
Well, and it also doesn't help that they face a really strong group of point guards over the next few weeks. Kemba twice, Steph Curry, Jamal Murray, but there are also a lot of really good point guards around the league. So it's kind of hard to dodge him. So we'll see where it goes from Chicago. It is possible that this season goes off the rails fairly quickly, but that's not necessarily a big surprise. It is great that Zach LaVine has been as awesome as he has offensively, and we'll see where it goes from there. I would say the next most important injury is actually one we'll talk about in their game section. So let's go to Houston. I mean, Houston is dealing with their own collection. Marquise Chris is dealing with an ankle issue, Nene with a calf issue, and James Ennis has a strained hamstring. So they're starting Michael Carter-Williams.
Yeah, and Chris Paul, of course, about to miss the second of his two games for being suspended. The Nene news is not really good either. You know, he was missed all this time with the calf, and then he's going to get an MRI, and that we'll see what happens there. And Ennis's hamstring, hopefully not major, but again, those are the type of things. Hamstrings and calves can be tricky, and Marquise Chris running out of time to convince the Rockets to pick up his fourth year option seems pretty unlikely that that's going to happen at this point. But yeah, I mean, I think the lack of a backup point guard, and then, you know, the D'Anthony Melton trade, they hoped that Brandon Knight could be in the rotation for them. He still has no time to really start doing some stuff, but, you know, still is not anywhere close to returning. And I think they miss Ryan Anderson offensively too, with the spacing that he provided. Even though he wasn't a playoff player, he really helped them in the regular season. Next place I want to go here is G League news. The Denver Nuggets finally will get a G League team. It'll be in the Denver suburbs. back where the Colorado 14ers used to play. I think 14ers refers to the number of 14,000 foot peaks in Colorado. Hopefully I'm calling that again. That's a pretty cool name. And that then just with New Orleans also establishing a G League franchise in Birmingham, which is further away than a lot of them are. But I think it'll play in Erie the first year, and then we'll move into Birmingham once the arena is done being renovated there. So that will leave only the Portland Trailblazers without a team. But it's fair, and you can make fun of them for that, but they've never been, you know, a cheap organization the way, you know, you can look at the Nuggets or Pelicans as having been. And the Blazers have probably done the best of just about any team of developing young guys who weren't playable at the start of their careers into rotation pieces. Jacob Lehman is the latest of that. Remember, CJ McCollum barely played his first 2 years. They developed Mo Harkless, who they brought in, Shaz Napier.
Connaughton.
Yeah, Connaughton is another one, although he's not playing now in Milwaukee, but they got something out of him. So yeah, I mean, maybe their belief is just simply that guys develop better just being around the NBA team on the roster, just developing more time for skills training. And I do think it's a legitimate criticism of the G League that the travel is so bad and the number of games. I think they should reduce the number of games in the G League. Or I think actually if I had, you know, players I was really trying to develop in the G League, I might just like have them play like, you know, 2/3 of the games or something, because you just, when you're traveling that much, you just can't work on your body.
I might only have them play in home games. That's probably what I would do.
Yeah. I mean, that's something to think about, but you know, obviously you can't just like run everybody else for 48 minutes when, you know, but I think you could definitely do some more resting there. Anyway, that's a little too philosophical. What else we got here?
Iron Man Andrew Wiggins had to leave the game on Monday, which they won against Indiana, with a thigh contusion. He plays on Wednesday the Wolves play on Wednesday against Toronto. I fully expect him to play, just because, I mean, one of only two games against the team he grew up, you know, following. And he basically never misses games. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. And in that same game, it looks like DeLon Wright is going to be ready to come back for Toronto, which is great, because even though the Raps have great depth, just having another capable piece. And, you know, this is a very big year for Wright, because he is about to hit restricted free agency, just like his backcourt second unit mate Fred VanVleet did this past summer.
Yeah, and it will, of course, be a very, very crowded point guard market in free agency this year with the number of one-year deals that were taken last year and just some good players coming up. Regardless, for the Knicks, Emmanuel Mudiay may be cleared to return on Wednesday with the ankle injury that's limited him for most of the season and camp, but we'll see whether he projects to be in the rotation right now. Ron Baker maybe is someone whose minutes he could take, but you know, he has certainly not been particularly effective for the Knicks, other than maybe finishing at the rim a little bit more. But he's got more upside than Baker does. And for the Bucks, Thon Maker, we haven't seen him really because he's been out with a groin injury. He's going to be active. We'll see whether he gets into the rotation or not. It seems like John Henson, you know, the Bucks are rolling right now. John Henson is the backup center. Christian Wood apparently is going to be inactive, so Maker will get a little bit of a shot. And then DJ Wilson is out with a hamstring, another guy who might be on the rookie option declined list. He's kind of running out of time, and that it'd be his third year option, which is the earliest option that can be declined. What else we got?
In the When It Rains, It Pours division, Jan Mahinmi left the Portland game with back spasms, a game Washington won, but it looks like he's questionable for Wednesday's game against Golden State. And Dwight Howard, as we talked about on the 15 and 60, did not make this road trip. So while he could theoretically meet the team at some point, it doesn't look like he's ready now. So that means probably more Markieff Morris at center. Jason Smith is going to have to take on some of those minutes. And, you know, this is it's a tough stretch. They can make it through it. They have before. But that's a lot to ask of their remaining bigs.
Yeah, Mahinmi had been kind of getting the Keith Bogans anyway. In Miami, yeah. Wayne Ellington won't be returning on Wednesday against the Knicks. He was going through shoot-around over the weekend. It's unclear if he suffered some sort of a setback, but we are going to see Justice Winslow probable to make his return on Wednesday from a hamstring injury he suffered a couple weeks ago. And James Johnson still with that. I don't understand why it has taken him so long to get back when he had hernia surgery 6 months ago. But he at least practiced 2 days in a row. He won't play against the Knicks, but he's getting close. The Grizz had a wonderful win in Utah, really held down the Jazz offense. And Chandler Parsons, who was actually in the starting lineup, was looking to be healthy, had to leave with right knee soreness 6 minutes into the game. And then Dylan Brooks also left that game with foot soreness. So they are very thin now at the small forward position. Maybe they'll see prize free agent signee Kyle Anderson play at the three, but that really is going to impact their shooting. Grizz D has been pretty good so far this year, but the offense is a little dicey. In Atlanta, John Collins, apparently, you know, there's talk, oh, he had this ankle procedure. It's minor. Who knows? It's not, he's not going to be out long. Well, he still won't be back for several weeks, apparently. And that's not a surprise. He had a surgery. Dwayne Dedmon, he is going to make his season debut against the Mavs in the Luka Doncic Trae Young Bowl on Wednesday. And the Hawks could really use him. They really, at center, they've had Alex Len, and then they've had Amari Spellman, and, you know, Dedmon is a big upgrade on either of those guys.
The other side of the Trae Young Luka Doncic Bowl, Dallas is going to be without Devin Harris and Harrison Barnes for that game. Devin Harris has a left hamstring strain. We don't have, I think he's definitely out for the next couple games, but then after that, we don't know. So that means more of a role for Jalen Brunson. And Harrison Barnes, they're targeting Friday per Rick Carlisle, but Friday is after Wednesday, so he will be unavailable.
Yeah, Harris was always a big injury risk. They signed him. They famously, they did let Yogi Ferrell go to sign with Sacramento by pulling his qualifying offer, and they're relying on Jalen Brunson now to give them good minutes. He's been okay so far in their 2-1 start against admittedly mediocre opposition, but, you know, we'll see. As a rookie point guard, he's an experienced rookie, but, you know, we'll see whether he's able to give them quality minutes or not. At least usually they play with two point guard lineups, so he's got JJ Barea with him there as well. He doesn't have to have the whole offense on his back. Really bad news though out of Brooklyn, Danny, for one of our favorites.
Yeah, Travion Graham, torn left hamstring. Expectation is that he will be out for 2 months. Brooklyn has lots of options on the forward spots, but I still really liked what he could do there, and he has I believe his is structured as a non-guaranteed second season, so hopefully he can have the chance to show something after that. But on the positive side, Shabazz Napier is going to be back on Wednesday versus the Cavs. They have plenty of depth at point guard, but they can always use more, just like every other team in the league. The Nets are actually the example I've used for that for years. So that's exciting that they can get him back and we get to see him in the black and white. And Aaron Baines looks like he's going to miss a couple of games due to his own hamstring issue, but obviously it's not nearly as severe as Travion Graham.
Yeah, he's only doing light jogging right now, and he's not going to accompany the team on their couple game road trip here. So it sounds like it could be at least a week for him, if not more. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, maybe Robert Williams can get some time here. Daniel Tice obviously is going to play as well. He hasn't looked quite as spry coming off of his own knee surgery as he did last season. So I'd like to, maybe we'll get to see a little bit of Robert Williams, but, you know, this would be interesting for Boston, who have already really kind of struggling with some minutes limits. Kyrie Irving shooting only 34% so far. Gordon Hayward's on a 25-minute limit. Who knows when that's going to be increased. And so Boston really, you know, it's not scoring nearly as well as it would have been hoped when you consider all of their talents. Also, just somewhat interesting here, Darius Bazley gets $1 million guaranteed from New Balance with incentives that can push it up to $14 million. He is going to intern for New Balance while also just training. He's not going to play in the G League this year. He was going to go to Syracuse and then pulled out of that to play in the G League, and then kind of decided, oh, wait a minute, I weigh $135. Maybe that's not a good idea to boost my stock. So he's just going to kind of sit out, do the Anthony Simons approach and see whether he can get drafted. We've seen guys who sat out for a year still get drafted okay, and New Balance getting back into the basketball shoe game. It's interesting that they are choosing Bazley. He wouldn't be my choice because I think if he makes an impact in the NBA, you know, it's certainly not going to be as a star, but maybe they just like his story, which I do as well. I commend him for trying to do something different rather than going to college.
Lower the age limit. We don't need this stuff anymore.
Well, one thing that you do need is Indochino. I actually need to post some of the wedding photos on Twitter because we got all of our stuff from Indochino. Sport jackets for my groomsmen. My tux was from Indochino as well. And if you don't know about Indochino yet, they make suits and shirts to your exact measurements for an unparalleled fit and comfort. And you can also personalize all the details, the size of the lapel, the linings, the pockets, the buttons. You can get it monogrammed. And now they're taking that same approach and expanding into casual clothing with made-to-measure chinos. $79 is the introductory price, and that's less than you're going to pay for a lot of chinos that aren't made-to-measure. They pair with anything, a suit jacket to a sweater, Sunday brunches, boardroom meetings. Chinos are quite versatile. And Of course, you can also go for their suits as well, available for only $359 for my listeners at Indochino.com. You enter that familiar cap space code at checkout. Easy to remember. We talk about it all the time here on the program. And get 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. Shipping is free. Go to Indochino.com and use that promo code CAPSPACE to get any premium suit for just $359 and free shipping. And don't forget that cap space code. Let them know that you came from us. So let's start with a game that was probably the game of the year so far. Just happened to be. It's so interesting how they don't really have any games on Tuesdays, but I kind of really enjoy doing gamers on Tuesdays because it lets us. There aren't necessarily marquee games, but we can kind of lock in on some of the teams that people don't pay as much attention to. And there aren't that many games. So you can usually watch all of them in pretty good detail. And this was the game of the year. And this is would shock me if this isn't like our game of the. I guess we do like the first month and a half when we do our awards. But I mean, this was just. A ridiculous yarn between Philly and Detroit.
It certainly was, and the game took on a little bit of a different tenor because Ben Simmons didn't play. Simmons was unavailable due to back soreness, and so what Brett Brown did in his stead was surprising to me. I guess you could say it from a continuity perspective. They started Landry Shamet. Shamet.
Yes.
I'm going to get it right at some point.
Damn it, Shamet. That's how do you remember.
Yeah. Yep. And so they started Shamet, brought JJ Redick off the bench. Redick, we'll talk plenty about his game, but they kind of kept that continuity, and you know, the starters had their trifles in this game, but the story overall of this is Blake Griffin having the best game of his career, excluding stakes, but just in terms of statistical stuff, the best game of his career.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you would have to look at his series against the Spurs in 2015 maybe as the high, but for Griffin, 50 points, 14 rebounds, 6 assists, missed his first 6 free throws. 5 of 10 from 3, 20 of 35 from the field in a 44-minute tour de force for Griffin. He was just killing the Sixers. And I said right at the start of the game in my notes to myself, because I was by myself, that I wanted to see whether Griffin would be able to take advantage of someone like Šarić, right? Like, that's, you know, a one-on-one matchup. And he was. He went right through Šarić. It helped also a ton that Joel Embiid got 2 early fouls and then was a very, very conservative until the end of the game as far as trying to attack around the rim. And he has this personal matchup with Andre Drummond. And so he was very concerned about keeping Drummond off the offensive glass. And so maybe wasn't as attuned to helping as he normally would be. But Griffin, I mean, he was just killing everybody. He was hitting pull-up threes off the dribble. I think he hit 6 threes against Chicago and then 5 in this game. Going right through Šarić, going right through even Mike Muscala and Amir Johnson. They tried to put Joel Embiid on him late, and then they went to 4 or 5 pick and rolls, and Embiid just, you know, didn't really know the coverage to deal with that as the on-ball pick and roll defender, and they had miscommunications. They gave up 2 dunks off of that, so they had to switch out of it, although Embiid did a better job actually guarding Griffin one-on-one than anyone else did. I mean, what do you think about what we've seen from Griffin in the early going here, where, you know, he's looked very difficult to stop in a way that, frankly, the last 2 seasons he has not.
He looked great, and I've been impressed with how the shooting and some of the development there has not impeded the other parts of offense that he did well. I thought his biggest highlights of this game, other than the last play, were actually passes. He had some just spectacular interior passes to Andre Drummond through narrow windows, and, you know, the type of thing that we were a little bit concerned about because the Pistons don't have a ton of spacing, but he made those work, and the attention that Griffin justifiably received in this game created opportunities for other guys. He only turned the ball over once, so you think about the usage in terms of shots and assists, only turned the ball over one time is fantastic. And, you know, it's kind of funny that he in many ways is having the early season that a lot of people hoped Kevin Love would have, where give him the ball more, a greater opportunity. And I mean, with the Pistons, it's just because they had this weird garbled season last year and he was only on the team for part of it and they fell out of it quickly. But he's been phenomenal.
And they really are almost using him now more like kind of a Ben Simmons or a LeBron James. He's bringing the ball up a lot, especially at the end of the game, you know, attacking off the dribble on switches. Most of his damage, I mean, he'll get into the post to be sure and use that big body, but he's dribbling into position a lot of times, almost never being used as a pick and roll role man anymore. And if they do that, then they're getting the switch more than it is him sort of attacking from the free throw line, trying to throw the lob to Andre Drummond the way he used to DeAndre Jordan. We haven't seen much of that from him in a Pistons uniform. You know, it's interesting that Toronto is like, oh, we're taking so many fewer mid-rangers. We're so much more modern with Dwayne Casey gone. But Dwayne Casey, he's getting the Pistons to shoot a lot more threes and encouraging guys to be very aggressive. And they're getting a lot more spacing, I think. I think that's really has helped Griffin. And we'll see. I really want to see, you know, how he looks against some of the better teams. You know, with Simmons out, Philly didn't really have anybody to guard him. But part of that is he deserves credit for that, because I think, you know, there are times when he was getting stopped by people like Sarge and wasn't able to be efficient. And then also just this three-point shooting, I mean, it's been ridiculous. He deserves so much credit, Danny. I mean, as someone who's kind of maligned, oh, he's just a dunker, blah, blah, like, to make himself into this kind of a three-point shooter, this kind of a skilled guy off the dribble, is really impressive. And, you know, we talked to on Sunday night's show about his chances for making the All-Star game. And, you know, we'll see. This is an early season blip. He's had some favorable matchups. We'll see if the Pistons continue at this pace. I mean, they're 3-0, but, you know, not exactly a murderer's row, and they're winning every game really close. Clearly, if he keeps up this kind of pace, he's going to make the All-Star team, and the Pistons too. But, yeah, I don't want to go crazy about this yet, but he certainly is looking pretty good. What else you got from this game? Obviously, we got to talk about the end too, but... what else struck you?
Well, I mean, the Pistons had a lot of trouble handling the handoffs to JJ Redick, which is surprising considering it's an absolute hallmark of Philadelphia's offense. And, you know, if you're going to coach kind of one thing, especially with Ben Simmons being out, I think somebody brought this point up on Twitter. I would give credit if I remember who it was. It's like, that's pretty much what you would do.
Schumann.
And Redick was getting loose all the time. He ended up with 30 points, 9 of 21 for the field. But you can have 30 points on 25 shooting possessions if you go 6 for 15 from 3, which he did. Also had 6 assists, no turnovers. And they now, without Bellinelli, do not really have maybe Shamit's going to get there eventually, like a kind of a proto Redick, but they still had him for 37 minutes in this game. And I also thought it was really nice. There was a moment in this game when Markel Fultz was taking, and he made a couple of jumpers, where I started remembering that, oh yeah, the original problem that we had with him was how bad he was on defense, including getting just absolutely disappearing on screens, was part of why I compared him to Kyrie Irving at the time. And there were moments in this game where I went, oh yeah, that was his original problem.
Yeah, you know, last year when he came in, I mean, I think he was so aware of the fact that he had these limitations that he was much more conscientious on defense. But now that he's playing big minutes, we haven't quite seen the same effort level. He did have one awesome chase down block, which he remains pretty good at. But yeah, he was definitely dying on some screens. The Sixers are going to play conventional pick and roll defense more often than not. And Fultz, I mean, had a pretty good statistical game. His best game of the season, 6 out of 9. He actually was finishing around the rim. He hit an open corner three as well off an offensive rebound. He pushed the ball, hit a couple of jump shots. Only had one assist, but he set up a couple of shots that just didn't go down. But yeah, on defense, he was a liability. McConnell is the superior player. McConnell played at the end of both halves, and obviously the overtime as well. Fultz finished with 21 minutes, but an encouraging game. And he was the main reason I wanted to turn in initially, because I wanted to see what it looked like with him out there without Simmons. And predictably, you know, he looked a lot more comfortable and they had a lot more spacing. I want to go back to what you said about Redick, though. You said it's, you know, surprising that these teams can't guard it. Well, I think there's a reason for that, and that is these new rules. I mean, he was very effective last year, but the new rules, he probably benefits more than any player in the entire league from these rules, because he is the most tireless off-ball worker in the NBA, and he's so fast and quick too, and he can get the ball going to his right for those jumpers. He never stops moving. If he gets stopped, he'll give it up, get it back in that DHO game, can get into the lane even at times going to his right and force some help, even if he's not a huge threat to finish anymore. But the only guy I've seen to be able to stop him, we've watched 3 Sixers games now, was Marcus Smart. I mean, even Jaylen Brown was struggling with him, and Redick just couldn't hit shots, but Brown was getting beaten over and over again. And like, if you're in a conventional system and Embiid kind of forces you to be in a conventional system because you don't want to get stuck in a mismatch on him, if you can't hold JJ Redick now, like, he's really, really difficult to stop, and the guy makes his shots. I mean, to get up 15 three-point attempts is really impressive. And you know, a couple times they overreacted to him, or I shouldn't say overreacted, they just properly reacted because he was hitting, especially when he came in right at the beginning, he was beating Langston Galloway pretty badly. So I think that's going to be something to watch, is like, how effective can he be now? You know, he could be on pace again for the best season of his career. It's just, they need him so badly. Again, you just got to wonder about it with him. He might even turn 35 this year, I think. You know, how many minutes can he play? I think it's good for Braun to bring him off the bench, if only because, number one, he's going to come in going against some backups who aren't as prepared for him. And number two, you know, he just can't really play more than 30 minutes, I don't think, and shouldn't if they wanted to be fresh for the playoffs. What else you got on this game?
Well, yeah, go ahead. Something I wanted to ask you about this game is the concept of development with Markelle Fultz. So there is an argument to be made that you want to start him, you want to throw him in the wolves and see how it works. But it bothered me a little bit that they did that approach for the start. They started him in all of their games so far, but then they didn't have him in at the end, presumably because they want to win. And so I feel like it's kind of mixed signals. They might be justified mixed signals, but I'm not sure how I feel about it. So I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, I think this is a reasonably happy medium at this point. You know, I do think that, and they've jiggered the rotation this way that anytime Simmons isn't in, he should be in. But you know, they take him out pretty early usually. So I think they're doing okay here. I mean, and Fultz did show some signs in this game. The jumper has looked better since those first couple of games. You know, and we didn't see Detroit really, and I thought Detroit's defense was pretty terrible in this game. But we didn't see Detroit really just like not guarding him and gumming everything up the way we saw Boston be able to do. And so for him to get experience against some of these other teams is good, and maybe he'll be able to contribute against the good teams by the end of the year, although more realistically he probably needs another summer of work on that jumper, and you know, maybe he still never gets there at that point. It was good to see him at least finish some shots though. Yeah, any other observations here before we talk about, we don't have to do play by play, but there's some big plays that stuck out towards the end that we should probably discuss.
Well, one thing I'll mention briefly, I was hoping to see more of Luke Kennard. I still am intrigued by his offensive potential, and I think the reason he didn't play as much is because he really did struggle defending JJ Redick, as a lot of guys do, both young and old, but especially the young guys, just because he's a totally different type of animal to deal with.
Yeah, although Kennard didn't play at all against the Bulls over the weekend, and
yeah, that's true.
So I think Galloway is just ahead of him in the rotation right now. And, you know, I didn't think Galloway looked that good defending Redick in this game either, but I think, you know, he's going to look better than Kennard. And that's something that Kennard is really going to have to improve on. Some small little things here. Joel Embiid, that early foul trouble may have decided the game ultimately, although he ended up playing 39 minutes and he had another monster game. Only one turnover, which was big for him, although it was a huge turnover forced by Zaza in overtime. But he had 33 points, 10 of 20 from the field, 11 of 14 from the foul line. 7 assists as well, which we haven't seen as much of from him. And he finally cranked up the defensive effort late after really, you know, not being that good early. And he even got dunked on in pretty nasty style by Blake Griffin on the fast break, in part because Blake made a really nice pass fake, but also because I think Joel was trying to avoid foul trouble. He kind of jumped out of the way a little bit. But he, I mean, against everybody who's not the Celtics, he continues to look just completely unstoppable and really being just turbocharged efficient for the first time in his career. And you know, I thought he really got the better of Drummond. Drummond was 6 out of 20 and just was going at him so hard, but just, you know, getting into his flip shot post-ups and, you know, missing a bunch of tips on the offensive glass and just, you know, he did make a couple of nice moves on Embiid and then just couldn't finish. And for him to be 6 out of 20 from the field, including 0 of 2 from 3, one of those was a heave, but the other one was just a trail 3 that he just, you know, missed by 3 feet and only hit the backboard. So it wasn't, and he also had 5 turnovers, which was pretty rough. But all that said, Drummond was still the only guy who had a chance of guarding Embiid. Zaza did have that one strip in overtime, but I thought the Sixers actually didn't go to Embiid enough down the stretch once Drummond was out of the game. We'll talk about how it was that Drummond was out of the game too, but Embiid got 4 fouls on Zaza in 7 minutes, you know, and just was able to face up and blow by him. The only thing about Embiid right now that's not working is the three-pointer. He was 3 of 5 against Orlando. That's the one game of theirs I haven't watched, so it's actually shooting 33% this year, but was 0 for 4 in this one despite having some pretty good looks. Any other just general observations here?
I think we're ready to get to the ending of this game,
so I think we can talk about Drummond's ejection, in which Embiid faced up, drove to his left, hits a lefty layup, and then Andre Drummond got ejected, a one technical ejection.
I'll correct you there. It was a two technical ejection. He had a tech from earlier in the game, which I think the box score like forgot about, but he did have one in like the second quarter. He was jawing with the ref. So it was a two technical. It was a two technical ejection.
Oh, okay.
That's why Embiid knew right away.
Oh, okay. Well, because this play-by-play I'm looking
at. The box score has it wrong. The play-by-play has it wrong.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I remember them saying that, and I figured I trust the box score of the announcers, but apparently I was wrong to do so. But the ejection, like, they thought that, like, somehow he had, like, taken a swipe at Joel, and Joel, like, fell down afterwards, and then Joel just started lobbying for him to get thrown out. Maybe the refs just, but it was just a completely ridiculous call to make at that point where it's a two-point game. How can you make that call when you're not dead sure? And why not at least call it like a flagrant foul instead, so you could just review it? Instead of, and like the fact that they couldn't go to the monitor on that, I'm not sure whether they have the ability to do that just on a technical.
I don't think they do, and I don't think even if they did, they would have the ability to rescind it.
Yeah, but that's
on, we biffed it. Well, but there's another important thing to mention about this too.
Yeah.
Which is that JJ Redick missed the free throw.
Right. Yeah, that was a good ball down line. I mean, maybe Drummond just said something that like, and I'm surprised I didn't see anything about a pool reporter after the game. But yeah, maybe Drummond just said something and that's why he got ejected. That's the only justification I could think of for it. But I mean, that's certainly, at least Detroit won, so they can't complain about it. JJ missed the technical free throw. And then Blake Griffin, in a 2-for-1 situation, made a really difficult 10-footer over Embiid. And this is after, you know, some really nice back and forth with Redick hitting a three, Reggie Jackson driving, McConnell, Reggie Bullock hit a jumper to put the Pistons up. And so the Sixers came back down after Griffin tied it up, a couple of misses, and then Šarić, who had a miserable shooting night, 2-for-11, had a wide open three after the Sixers ran some nice action to get Redick open. They collapsed on him. Šarić had a wide open right wing three, just couldn't knock it down. He's struggled on some open shots this season.
One thing I want to mention, the Sixers did something I really liked that was in that interim time, which is, so you said that the Pistons went for that, got that 2-for-1. So Blake Griffin tied the game with about 35 seconds left. The Sixers had two timeouts left. They used their first of their two timeouts, moved it across, and actually got up a shot quickly enough to make their own 2-for-1. That shot was a Joel Embiid three that missed, but I still like the decision making there from Brett Brown to give his team an extra chance at it, though it ended up not bearing any fruit.
Yeah, so it ended up being a 2-for-2 as it turned out, but it was still an attempt to get the 2-for-1. Pistons jumped out early with 2 3-pointers. Ish Smith had a couple of threes in this game. The Pistons closed with Smith and Reggie Jackson together. Dwayne Casey likes his 2-point guard lineups. You'll recall that he was a Mavs assistant under Rick Carlisle, who also liked the 2-point guard alignments, brought that to Toronto, where it was very successful. Now, you know, they have two quality players, but Smith, I mean, he's never going to be a great 3-point shooter. His form is just too ugly. It takes him forever to get off. But, you know, when teams are just totally leaving him, he's been able to make them pay early in the season. But the Sixers roared back, tied the game at 128 with Redick scoring most of those points. Embiid did not score in the overtime, and Zaza had one big steal with 57 seconds left. I still felt like they should have gone to him more. And then after Redick missed a tough jumper, tied at 128 with 20 seconds left, Redick just fouls Reggie Jackson. And I think he thought either that they were down or that he had a fast break and he was going to Euro foul and they had a foul to give, but neither was the case. So he just fouls Reggie Jackson with 20 seconds left. And Jackson hits 2 free throws, but then Redick just makes up for that total bonehead play with a spectacular one.
Yeah, I mean, he comes off, as I recall it, he came off a screen and then he got hit by Reggie Jackson, who had just made that shot, and makes the shot. So it's a 4-point play. So it takes a 2-point deficit to a 2-point lead with only 6 seconds to go in the game.
Yeah.
And the Pistons had a timeout.
And if I may, on that play, if you're going to continue, Redick, Jackson, I thought, did a really nice job of defending him. He knew exactly what he wanted to do, which was come out along the baseline. So Reggie Jackson just basically stood where he wanted to go. And so Redick just sprinted right up the lane line instead. And Embiid set a semi-illegal screen, kind of tripped Jackson. And then Redick, is just so deadly going to his right. I mean, I think my number one thing about how to defend that DHO would be make him shoot that going to his left instead of going to his right, because he really just seems to like that much better, and especially driving to his right as well off of that play. But and then he kind of kicked his leg out, and you know, but in a natural way. It was definitely a foul on Reggie Jackson. So Sixers up two with 5.6 left, and Pistons advance the ball in the front court. They brought in a bunch of shooters around Blake Griffin. And what did you think of the final play?
It looked really familiar because it was one of the more memorable plays at the end of a game last yes. regular season was Jonas Valanciunas doing a fake DHO, then rolling the lane and getting the buzzer beater dunk on John Henson. That should have been an and one and should have ended the game. Instead, sent that ridiculous one to overtime. I believe Toronto did end up winning that game. No, Giannis, I think, had a crazy save. Maybe the Bucks did win it. I can't remember at this point, but it was the same play. And so I was cracking up because I thought that happened against the Pistons, and I thought that would have been too perfect, but no, it happened against Milwaukee. But it is a favorite of Dwayne Casey, and Blake Griffin is a fantastic person to run that play, especially if Amir Johnson misdiagnoses the play and just is nowhere around.
Well, a couple of things here. Everybody's running that play now. The Warriors ran it against Denver, and Draymond Green got to the foul line on the same play. And really, you know, with that amount of time remaining, you're probably better off switching. But I knew it was going to be trouble. I didn't know what play they were going to run, but I knew it was going to be trouble because with 5.6 left, Brett Brown went to we're going to put our biggest guy on the inbounder with Amir Johnson, but he's guarding Reggie Bullock and he can't guard Reggie Bullock. He's way too slow for that. The inbounder is often the most dangerous player on those plays. And I'm not sure whether, you know, the play was specifically fake DHO. You know, they could have just, and especially with a 2-point lead, you know, you don't want to give up a three to Reggie Bullock coming off of that DHO from out of bounds. But I saw that. I was like, there's way too much time. Like, if there's like 1.5 seconds left, then yeah, put your biggest guy in the inbounder, make it a tough pass. But there's no way Johnson could stick with him. And so predictably, Bullock got an advantage on Johnson. That led to a miscommunication where Griffin's man had to jump out on Bullock and Johnson wasn't able to switch on to Griffin. And Griffin goes right to the basket because they had so much spacing. Covington was late coming over. They didn't really have a rim protector available, especially because, you know, the two bigs for the Sixers were out on the floor. They had Embiid, I think, guarding Griffin. And so he goes right in. Then Robert Covington with the cardinal sin. I mean, you're desperate to prevent a tying play, but, you know, he wasn't in any kind of position to stop him and to give up, you know, a pretty flimsy foul. But, you know, your problem there, too, is like you don't want to commit a flagrant either. So and I think that's a good rule to just prevent a guy from getting killed like that. So maybe he should have just let him go. But, you know, it's obviously a very tough situation to be in. You don't want to just give up the tying layup, but at least, you know, you live to fight another day potentially. And so Griffin gets the and one and makes the free throw. He missed his first six and then made his last five, all of which were clutch. And the Sixers tried to run a little flare screen for Joel Embiid, but it was pretty well defended and he had to take and miss a difficult three-pointer to end it.
So another nice, you know, a nice win for the Pistons, one they can hang their hat on for a little while now. And the Sixers, you know, I think that there was enough here to look at without playing with Ben Simmons. And, you know, there were times in this game when I was really happy with Fultz. And I'm still concerned about Šarić's shooting. Like, if that doesn't go back to what it was last year, the Sixers become easier to defend. But, you know, just a really fun game. And I'm thrilled that Griffin have put this together, you know, after our concerns about whether, you know, he's not the same guy he used to be. He's a different player. And the way that the league has evolved has maybe given him a new lease on relevance.
Yeah, and I think what I'd like to see even more of from the Pistons is, you know, the 4-1 pick and rolls now to really, or 4-2 pick and rolls to get Blake that matchup and let him really get down in the post and bludgeon, especially because he has the ability to shoot that three now. I think that can be pretty effective for them. We only saw them go to that a couple of times, but, you know, when he has a little bit harder of an individual matchup, they might want to go there. And the 4-5 pick and roll worked really well. I mean, I still, you know, we'll see what kind of spacing this team can come up with. Stanley Johnson, they didn't really need him in this game. He was 0-for-5, but, you know, his role is really, he's really their only like defender with any size on the wing. But they didn't, since Ben Simmons didn't play, they didn't really need him to guard anybody. I thought Reggie Jackson, you know, still doesn't look particularly spry, but he's been aggressive with the three-point shot. That's looked pretty good for him. But important to remember, I mean, this is actually somewhat analogous to when they started 4-0 last year with Griffin, with every win at home versus a team on the second night of a back-to-back and most of them being close. Like, they're 3-0, but they've won by what, a combined like 6 points over the Nets at home, the Bulls, and then the Sixers without Ben Simmons. So, and a bunch of other injuries as well. So I'm not going to say, like, you know, they probably should have been favored to win all of those games. Now, they do have 3 wins in the bank, which is nice, but I'm not going to totally change my tune. I think if I had to guess, I would say they're going to beat the 36 wins that I picked them for, although they haven't had any injuries set in either. You know, if Griffin goes down, they're in big trouble. Zaza is not a good option as a backup center. You know, the Sixers weren't going to stress them out as far as, like, you know, making Zaza play pick and roll defense or anything like that. So, and I did think that Griffin was pretty bad defensively in this game. You know, they don't really, this was an offensive game to be sure, but I'm not sure I believe in this team's defense very much at this point.
And the Pistons will have a clarifying stretch at the end of October, beginning of November, where they go an Atlantic Division road trip, Boston, Brooklyn, Philly, home for one game against Miami, which is brutal, and then out to Orlando and Atlanta. So I think they'll do well on the second kind of leg of that trek, but then the first one will be clarifying with Boston and Philly and Brooklyn, you know. And Brooklyn, a tough thing for Detroit in this is they faced the weakest team as the tail end of a back-to-back. So you would go, if you're thinking about the schedule in the abstract, you would say, oh, that's the easiest one. But those can often be challenging games for teams, especially early in the season. That'll be their first back-to-back of the whole year.
Something else that's challenging is credit card debt, or unexpected repairs, or medical expenses. Sometimes a little money can make a big difference. You can get it at LendingClub.com, which gives you access to low rates on loans of up to $40,000 for almost any purpose. It's easier than going to a bank, and they offer lower rates than high-interest credit cards. Go to LendingClub.com, enter the amount you need, and you can see if you're approved in just minutes. And then the money can be in your account in just days. They've been at it now for more than 10 years, helping millions of people with over $31 billion in loans. Take charge of your finances today with LendingClub. Go to LendingClub.com/capspace. /capspace. We talk about it all the time in the program. You can check your rate for free, and checking your rate won't impact your credit score. Once again, LendingClub.com/capspace. LendingClub.com/capspace. All loans made by WebBank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Let them know with that /capspace URL that you came from us. Where do you want to go next?
Can I go with the picture? Can I go with the big picture insight on the Clippers-Pelicans game?
Yes.
I hadn't watched a ton of either of these teams yet, but I watch bits and pieces because they're both teams I enjoy watching. And what struck me about this game was that I thought both teams played below the level that they played most of this season so far, but I think that made me actually feel better about their viability this season, and I'll clarify that. And so what I mean is the Pelicans didn't have everything go right. Nikola Mirotic didn't hit 6 of 8 threes. Julius Randle had a good game. I mean, Anthony Davis was still ridiculous. Drew Holiday struggled from the field, and yet they still beat a capable team. And the Clippers, you know, this wasn't Boban going crazy. He got exposed a little bit in 1 minute, never really came in. Avery Bradley had a weird game. Shea was fine. And they still were competitive against a team that I fully expect to make the playoffs in the West. And so it happens sometimes where you're just sitting there going, okay, these teams are going to be able to go through battles and make it out the other side more often than not. It's just that they were facing a capable opponent, so it was a little harder on them.
Yeah, and the biggest difference in this game was Anthony Davis plays the New Orleans Pelicans, and the Clippers, for all their depth and the number of solid players that they have, really had no answers for him whatsoever, and they're particularly thin up front. You mentioned that Boban, -4 in 1 minute. Gortat got the Keith Bogans. He was -13 in 12 minutes. Montrezl Harrell, actually, maybe you could argue, could have played more. He had 12 points and was +7 in 23 minutes. But they spent a lot of this time, especially in the fourth quarter, as they were trying to come back, with Gallo and Harris as the two quote-unquote bigs, Tobias Harris, and then with three guards in the lineup. They played in Bob Mute a little bit there too. But when you see teams go to these ultra small lineups, and you would think, I'd be like, oh yeah, go small, that's what we're all about. Well, not as much here. I mean, they were down. I think they kind of just needed to try something to jolt the game a little bit, because the Pels were pulling away in the mid third quarter into the fourth. They're up by 10 basically for most of that time after a 32-22 third quarter. But going small works when you have a bunch of players who have some size or some, if not rim protecting instinct, help instincts. You know, if you have a PJ Tucker or a Draymond Green, so someone who at least like thinks like a helper. You know, Danilo Gallinari and Tobias Harris are very nice offensive players, and they both had really good games in this one, but neither of those guys is going to be able to provide any kind of help whatsoever. And so, you know, they're trying to front, they're trying to switch. They did at least take away the three-pointer. The Pels only got up 24 threes, which is a lot fewer than they've been getting. And they made only 25% of them. Both teams shot 25% from three. But that was just stark contrast when the Pels have Davis out there. Even, you know, Randall and Mirotić are, you know, more traditional bigs than the Clippers were able to get out there. What'd you think of like how Avery Bradley looked? I haven't seen him have much effect, even on defense and offense. You know, he's been relatively underwhelming too so far this year.
It's a growing concern for me. I do definitely want to watch him more before making any big pronouncements, but you know, this, he doesn't to me look like the guy that I hoped that he would be after last year, you know, such a lost year with the groin issues. And he's sitting there going, oh man, if he could be what he was, that would be such a useful piece for them, even though they're starting Patrick Beverley as the other guard, and he gets after it defensively. They could, this kind of attack dog mentality defensively, especially with the limitations they have at the big man spot defensively. But he just hasn't really brought it to me on either end of the floor. And they have other options, but I'm not sure they want any of the other options starting at the two, at least at the moment. So they'll probably stick with Bradley for now. But I would say at this point, from what I've seen, he's the weak spot in the rotation, and he's the harder one to replace. Like if Harrell could supply Gortat pretty easily if they wanted to go that direction. Gortat can be a backup. You can use Boban, all those sorts of things. But unless they want to move Shea up, there isn't really a cohesive way, because Tobias Harris and Danilo Gallinari are not going to chase around two guards for a whole night.
Yeah, and Lou Williams, I mean, they, in theory, some of the hope was, well, Bradley and Beverly, who've been starting for them, can make up for some of their defensive deficiencies elsewhere. That hasn't really been the case. But, you know, if Bradley's going to continue shooting at this, he's 8 out of 31 on the season and 1 out of 10 from 3 in 4 games. You know, and he definitely, you know, he was being taken, when he'd be taken out of the game, he'd kind of be shaking his head. You know, he's got money on the line for next year with that non-guarantee. It was hoping, I'm sure, to come back. It didn't seem like he really wanted to come back to the Clippers, but because they had his bird rights and there just wasn't any other kind of a market out there for him. I mean, remember, people were talking about him getting $20 million a year from the Sixers as the missing piece for them. And he has not made the defensive impact. It really just didn't show up. Like, you didn't notice that he was out there on the floor in any way. So that'll be something to monitor for him. AD, worth just talking about his line here. 34 points, even if, as he only shot 10 out of 15 from the foul line, but 5 offensive rebounds, 5 blocks. He had 5 blocks through 29 minutes in this game. The Clips, on the other hand, just no rim protection at all. We talked about that a little bit. Julius Randle had another monster game with 18 points in 22 minutes, although he did foul out some decent calls, some questionable calls, but he just 5 of 9 from the field, 7 of 7 from the foul line. Another team that really just have no one to deal with Julius Randle. I mean, he's looking like he and Redick are looking like the early favorites for sixth man, although I'm sure I'm forgetting someone. I haven't looked at all the stats. But I mean, for the Pels to win with Drew Holiday, 2 of 15, going 6 out of 24 from 3, was pretty impressive. And Nikola Mirotić was 0 for 6 from 3, but he, again, was able to get some work done from 2. I mean, I wonder when the last time was that he made 7 2-point shots. What have you think of what you've seen from Elfrid Payton so far this year?
He's been better than I expected. Does a lot of his damage in transition, which is a great fit. I mean, just when they get stops, and they've had some nice defensive runs in this, then he can get out there. And then I think teams aren't attacking Payton's weaknesses aggressively enough yet. That might end up being more of a playoff thing than a regular season thing, just because teams don't have these specific scouting reports. He is the 8th Pelican, probably the 7th Pelican on your scouting report, because he's certainly behind Julius Randle. So talented player to be sure, but they have all these other options there that are focused the attention. So he's been fine in defensively. I haven't seen as much of the limitations of going with Payton and Holiday together. I've always thought it would be nice to pair somebody a little bit bigger with Drew, because then you can be a little bit more versatile, but it's worked out pretty well. One other guy I want to single out, this happens for me sometimes with Etuan Moore, but also with other guys, where I thought he hit more than 2 3-pointers in this game, because the 2 he hit were very important.
Yes.
They were both a part of that big run they went on. It was 20 21-4. He had, I think it was like, he bookended that run, I believe, with a three that tied the game and then one that really pushed the margin out there. And I just love what he can do for this team. And Etuan Moore, to me, more of a two than a three. He's played that role now for them for a while now, and he's just really excelling in an unheralded spot that we thought was going to be a big problem area for them.
Yeah, getting back to Payton, he had 20 points. He had three steals as well. It's good to see him being more active in the passing lanes. I think he looked really good that way as a rookie, and then it had kind of gotten away from that. He still can't get over a screen. You mentioned attacking his weaknesses. The Clippers did do pretty well with a set where they had Danilo, they got the ball into the post just for passing purposes, and then they had Gallinari setting a back screen for whoever Payton was guarding, and then if they helped on the back screen, Gallinari was able to just pop out for the jumper, or they got a couple of layups going back door. I thought Beverly, actually, in contrast to Bradley, he's coming off, in theory, a more severe injury, but Beverly, with that meniscus repair, looks pretty good. He had 12 points, 8 assists, 10 rebounds, and he was a guy who you noticed more, you know, going after loose balls, pressuring up defensively, just sort of being a general irritant than maybe you did with Bradley. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander came back to earth a little bit, but, you know, still looked okay. There was one notable sequence where he beat Anthony Davis with one of his patented lefty scoop shots, and then he tried the same move on him, like, the next possession, and AD just, like, completely swallowed him whole. I think that's about all I've got. One more thing too. The Clippers seem to be, watch for this when you watch their games, the first time I noticed it. They seem to really be teaching faking a jump shot, getting the guy in the air, and even if they can't draw the foul, giving it up and then immediately cutting backdoor when their man is kind of just moving towards them. They got a couple of nice buckets that way, but I saw a lot of the Clippers trying to do that. So that might be something that they're just teaching now. So that'd be interesting to watch for. All right. Yeah, I think that's all I got on this one, unless you
get some more. I'll mention, I think Boston does that too.
Yeah.
Not as much as the Clippers do, but, and it's not like there's a big connection between Doc and Brad Stevens, but it's a good process because you're getting somebody going the wrong direction.
All right, we can finish up here with the Kings and Nuggets. Sacramento, brilliant win on the road in Oklahoma City. De'Aaron Fox has had a wonderful start to the season. My biggest observation in this one on the Kings was that he really crashed back to earth in this one. He was negative 22, 6 points, 2 of 8, but even more so, I felt that he just didn't come to play at all defensively. You know, he really made bad decisions on defense, you know, things like not boxing out, just letting a guy go right in, Trey Lyles go right in for a tip dunk. Then the next possession, he gets Lyles on a switch and does a ridiculous gamble for a steal 20 feet from the basket that had no chance and gives up another dunk, you know, not like anyone helped him at all. Anytime he got posted up, he just was kind of giving up, getting destroyed, or committing a foul. Just lots of bad gambles on the perimeter. I think, you know, if he looked at the film, you know, he's a very kind of heady young player. And I don't know whether it was the altitude or just, you know, he just wasn't engaged in the game mentally on the defensive end. He didn't make good decisions on offense. He wasn't the same force pushing the ball. The Kings, just in general, their transition defense was atrocious in this game. Like, every miss by the Kings turned into a Nuggets fast break. It seemed like they only had 18 fast break points, but a lot of those came in the first quarter when the Nuggets surged out to a lead, and then they really just steadily outscored the Kings, and they were up by 20 midway through the third, and that was pretty much the game. But it got a few more observations, but what are your general thoughts?
Some real highlight plays from Marvin Bagley in this one.
Yeah.
He defensively, he looked better than I expected, and this wasn't quite the same thing. In the preseason, there was some hype around his block totals, and I was a little bit, not bothered, but a lot of those were him being underneath the rim and just like making a play on the guy who's driving. These were a little bit more versatile blocks. There was one where he was kind of trailing the play. I think it was on Monty Morris. I can't remember exactly who it was on. And he kind of caught him with a block, which is a nice play, especially if Bagley's going to be at power forward. I still think defensively his best position is center. Also had some nice finishes. And so, yeah, I thought this, there, he's been very up and down so far this year, but this was definitely an up for him.
Yeah, I mean, he does have one of the quickest second jumps you're ever going to see, and it showed off one time when Trey Lyles faked him out of his shoes on an up and under, and Bagley jumped, landed, and then jumped again before Lyles could even get off the floor and blocked his shot. That was awesome. He even had some pretty aware help plays. Like, there was one play where they're trying to topside Monty Morris, and Jokic threw a beautiful backdoor pass, and Bagley actually came down from the free throw line and, you know, stopped Morris from taking the shot. So he's shown more awareness than I thought he would, even in summer league. We were saying that he looked a little bit better than expected defensively. He's got a long way to go. It's also amazing how much he's able to get done with just like so left-handed. I mean, he's like Domantas Sabonis style left-handed, but he's way more explosive than Sabonis. And you know, even Sabonis, like, he's able to be pretty efficient with that one hand. I think once guys realize just how left-handed he is, he might have a few more problems. But even when guys are sitting on his left hand, he just goes further left and he's able to just jump over them and around them. You know, the straight post-ups don't work that well, you know, because he's always going to go right shoulder. Anytime he gets stuck going left shoulder, I mean, he's just bringing the ball right back into the defense and just has to throw up some crap. It always looks really bad. But no, I think he's actually exceeded my expectations early in the season. But Denver just continuing to play extremely well. They're 4-0, although they've had three home games. But I mean, I think one of the things that I had said is, oh, I don't trust them to go over in the over-under podcast because they don't take care of business necessarily. Like, their defense is bad enough that, you know, bad teams could be in any game, but they just have completely throttled Phoenix and the Kings, the two bad teams that they've played so far at home. And they continue to defend pretty well. I mean, the defense wasn't as good in this one. The Kings got back into it late to make it a respectable 14-point loss after trailing by 24 after three. So I'm still not buying the Nuggets on defense yet. This is only four games. The Warriors shot extremely poorly against them in that game the other day. Their individual defenders, I think, are just not quite good enough. And when they're going up against teams that have like really good players and really good pick and roll attacks, you know, they haven't really faced that quite yet. But, you know, they're still going to put Jokic in space. We haven't seen a team do a ton of that yet. Jamal Murray is only okay at best. But they do have Millsap and Craig. I worry about his offense, but Millsap was excellent. And then Millsap had one of his better offensive games in a while with 15 points on 11 shooting possessions because he was really just able to go through everyone that the Kings had. The Kings, you know, generally the only pure power forward they're playing at the four is Bagley. They're starting Bielitsa at the four, but Millsap was able to just go right through him. Anyone else who stuck out to you in this game?
Yeah, I wanted to give a little bit of mention to another efficient night from Gary Harris.
Yeah.
18 points, 8 of 12 from the field, had a few really nice drives to the basket, and I just really like him as a complimentary piece, and that might be selling him short. I'm open to the possibility that he can be more than that, but I think he's a good player. I think he fits really well with this team and with Jamal Murray. Both those guys can handle the ball. Both those guys can initiate. And those two and Jokic, I think you have a lot that you can work with there. And now they just need to figure out the best path at those two forward spots. And the other thing we should mention on the Nuggets in general is the news that while it looked really bad, I didn't see it. And then there was an early prognosis that might have been better. Will Barton had surgery, I believe it was on Tuesday.
Yeah.
For an adductor muscle, and he's expected to be out 5-6 weeks, and it might even be beyond that. It's, you know, they're gonna have to see where it goes. And so
he's being reevaluated in 6 weeks, so that means,
he's reevaluated in 6 weeks. So that means like 8 or 10.
Yeah, like that reevaluation would be okay, you can start like ramping up your activities. So yeah, I mean, I think it's, and it also he had like a core muscle injury as well, so this mm-hmm. I mean, that might be like a hernia. It definitely does not sound good, and it seems like one of those things, like, you know, is he going to be able to come back and really be himself? And that's probably the biggest I mean, they're not that deep anyway, I mean, but it's one of the bigger positions they couldn't afford an injury at. And, you know, Craig, I think good teams are going to not guard him as much. He's 2-for-9 from three so far on the year, but he gets left open all the time. We'll see whether Wancho plays. His three-pointer hasn't looked amazing. Trey Lyles is getting some more minutes now as well. A couple more notes. Jamal Murray finally broke out. He was 0-for-8 against the Warriors in their win, but he basically ended the game with 11 straight points in the third quarter, including two really tough step back threes off of Willie Cauley-Stein switches. And then for the Kings, Iman Shumpert actually looks really good. He had 24 against the Thunder in that win. He looks much thinner, like, just good to see him be able to get healthy. He's had lower body issues these last couple of years, but remember, he was a very valuable player and got that pretty good contract after the 2015 finals, and then he's kind of, you know, hasn't been able to contribute as much since then. But his three ball looks quicker. He was 2-of-5 from three in this game as well. You know, he's probably the best defensive guard that they have. Remember, Bogdanovich is out right now. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. The Kings, you know, again, they're starting, whether you want to call Shumpert or Hield, the three. I mean, there's a lot of teams that just, like the Nuggets are another one, that just like don't really have a three. And so when both teams don't have a three, you can just start three guards. And that's, you know, another reason why you're going to see some of these huge offensive totals. Harry Giles has looked really bad so far this year. He has a PER of 1 right now. He's had some staggeringly bad plus minuses. He was negative 20 in 14 minutes. And he was 0 for 6. His usage is 25, but he really has no way to create efficient offense. It's either going to be a mid-range 2 or it's going to be trying to post up. But he doesn't have like great explosion, great strength, or great moves in the post. You know, he kind of like maneuvers into like a hook shot that's pretty contested from 10 feet. And so Scal only played 5 minutes. He had some moments in the preseason. I think Scal might deserve more of a look than Giles at this point. Justin Jackson has had some nice scoring games as well. He did in this one with 17 points. He's been able to pick up where he left off scoring wise in summer league, although he's not an amazing defensive option for them. And
Sacramento has this dynamic again where the margin between their starters and their backups is narrower than almost every other team. Part of the reason also their backups had good plus minuses in this game is because there was some garbage time towards the end. I mean, they did narrow the margin and then, you know, kind of changed a little bit. But it was, you know, I thought it was functionally over for a lot of the fourth quarter. But, you know, having Frank Mason, Yogi Ferrell, Bagley when he's on one of those up days, that's a lot for that. And I mean, their starting quality, especially without Bogdanovich right now, is lower than just about every team in the league. So we'll see where it goes over the course of the season. And I want to talk about this on the 15 and 60, but the single biggest storyline other than De'Aaron Fox for this team is where all of these big guys they have this just cavalcade of bigs, most of them being very young, other than Zach Randolph, who's not playing. And where do these guys slot in on a better team? Like, if the Kings get better, like they hope to, and it's going to take a while to figure out where all these guys fit in, but at least they have a lot of them, I guess.
You mentioned that Zach Randolph isn't playing. He hasn't played a minute. I don't know if he's even been active for a game yet. And, you know, James Hamm said on the preview pod that we did way back in August that he wasn't going to play at all this year, and that certainly was correct. And, boy, I mean, nobody has parlayed a shittier offseason into a new job better than Scott Perry. I mean, they've got Randolph just completely dead money for $12 million this year, and they were, you know, basically the worst team in the league last year with him. George Hill had to be traded. They picked up Shumpert's actually playing well, but to take him on, it was dead salary. So, I mean, that was just like, everyone was like, oh, that's such a great offseason. Like, the Kings are going to be respectful. Like, no, that was awful. And great job by Hip getting out of there before it became apparent, like, how awful that was. Let me see if I have anything else here.
Can we call that a version of the George Costanza exit?
Yeah. Willie Cauley-Stein looks better. He's really improved his finishing around the rim, which was a major weakness for him. He just had no touch. He's hitting like lefty hooks now. He's able to actually take a couple of dribbles and do some stuff. You trust him to finish around the rim when they throw it to him. And then Mason Plumlee remains one of my least favorite players in the NBA to watch because he just like, he tries to post up so often. Like, he posts up like more often than Jokic does. And you know, you're just taught as a guard when someone posts up and demands the ball to throw it to him. But like, then he like tries to make these moves, and then there's a bunch of times where he's posting up and he's just like right in the way of superior players. It's just, all right, if he wants to like handle the ball up top and like do some DHOs, okay, that's great, but like, just go run some pick and roll. Get out of the post, Mason. Like, you're not good at it. And this is a great offense. Like, he's taking possessions out of the hands of guys who are much, much better than he is.
It will be a little bit harder for them to generate offense just with... this is the with Will Barton thing. Not necessarily because if Torrey Craig is there, you know, it doesn't really change much about their second unit offense. But just now, they're all at risk of any further injuries changing up the rotation even more. So they're gonna need a lot from the guys they have. And hopefully at some point, they're going to get Isaiah. We don't know when that's going to be, but you know, maybe Plumlee thinks he needs to take on a lot of that load, but I'd rather see Trey Lyles have the ball more often. I think he's capable, and then, you know, they can go in other directions as well. But yeah, it's weird that I guess I am the one with less Mason Plumlee vitriol at the moment. That feels weird to me.
Also a cool thing about Denver, I mentioned their fast break. Part of that is facilitated by the fact that whoever gets the rebound, even if it's Jokic or Millsap, just has permission to bring the ball up. And I think that kind of keeps guys engaged. It's just fun to bring the ball up. But also it lets the smalls, if it's clear that they're going to get the rebound, those guys can just take off. You know, they don't need to wait back to get the outlet pass necessarily. Those guys can just take off towards half court. If the hit ahead pass to half court is there, they can throw it, or, you know, Jokic or Millsap can just push the ball up instead. So I think that's really helping their fast break game. All right, I think that's about it here. Anything we got to talk about before we go?
No, not really. I mean, we could tell people that the Twitter NBA show will be back on Thursday for those that would prefer having hearing the two of us talk about a game as opposed to TNT announcers, you can enjoy that.
Yeah, and also don't forget about our Patreon. We got ad-free versions of the show now. You can sign up at patreon.com/dunkandlure. They go up a little bit later, usually early in the morning, East Coast. That's when Liam wakes up. You know, it would be 3:23 a.m. for him right now as I'm saying this, so not realistic for him to do that before we put it up at the normal time here. But and of course you get so much more at Patreon as well, patreon.com/DunkandLaRue, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Till then.